Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lock your doors. Close the blinds. Change your passwords. This is the Dry Cleaner Cast. Welcome to the Dry Cleaner Cast, a podcast that takes a new look at the war on terror, its legacy, and espionage in the 21st century. This podcast is written, edited, and presented by Chris Carr.
The Dry Cleaner Cast is a series of podcasts that look at terrorism and espionage in the 21st century. The podcast is a companion to my short film, The Dry Cleaner. We hope by helping people further understand the complexity and sensitivity of the issues that surround terrorism, we can be a part of the necessary debate that will help defeat terrorism in the near future. Today I'm on location at King's College London, and I'm joined by Shiraz Mayer, who is a senior research fellow at the International Centre for the Study of Radicalisation at King's College. He is also author of the book Salafi Jihadism, The History of an Idea, and today we will be discussing Salafi Jihadism.
Opinions expressed by guests on this podcast do not necessarily represent those of the filmmakers and sponsors of the film, The Dry Cleaner.
So Shiraz, welcome to The Dry Cleaner Cast.
Thank you.
Can you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I'm a Deputy Director of the International Centre for the Study of Radicalisation, and I've been working at King's now for about 6 years, working a lot on jihadist movements and jihadist groups. But my own particular research interests are much more closely related to the ideology and to some of the theological debates that these groups have been having over time. And so that's what I've really been focusing in on.
Yeah, excellent. Can you just tell us a little bit about the International Centre for the Study of Radicalisation and the work that you do there?
So we were set up originally in 2008 as a sort of response to the 7/7 terrorist attacks. There was a feeling within the college that there had to be an independent centre that was looking at these issues in an objective way and in an evidence-led way, because a lot of the stuff you see with terrorism studies and with a lot of popular commentary is based on anecdotal stuff. It's not always particularly objective. It's usually led by the political agenda of the day. And so the college, quite wisely in my opinion, clearly thought that they should have a centre that looked at and worked on these issues. And we do a range of things. So I lead the work here on Syria and Iraq, but we have colleagues who look at the far right. We have colleagues working on movements across Europe. We have others looking at stuff in sub-Saharan Africa or the Horn of Africa. So we're trying to increase our global reach, but clearly the conflict in Syria and Iraq is dominating what we're doing right now.
You've written a fantastic book called Salafi Jihadism, The History of an Idea. Can you tell us what it's about and what inspired you to write it?
Well, in terms of what the book is about, it was really the fact that we saw the rise of all these different groups. So we had Al-Qaeda and everyone sort of talked about Al-Qaeda. But then you have a group called ISIS or Islamic State that comes later. You have groups like Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab and all these different things coming up. And, you know, I thought there was a need to really try and explain their ideas and the theological debate that these movements had had from the perspective of the ideologues to get them to where they are today. And so that in a nutshell is what the book aims to do. It's a history of ideas. So it's not a history where you're saying in 1993 bin Laden was here and he met with this guy and they agreed X. What you're saying is these events happened, for example, Saddam invading Kuwait, and the political aftermath of that is quite profound for jihadists in the Middle East, and they're talking amongst themselves about what they should do. And it's those debates, the religious, theological unraveling that takes place within these guys and within their movements about how they're going to respond. So it's quite different and unique from a lot of the histories that are out there currently looking at these types of things, because it treats ideas rather than the people. In terms of, you know, I suppose the inspiration to write it, to be honest, I never knew I was writing this book when I started. I was originally setting out to look at Al-Qaeda, specifically as a movement, and to show the ideas within that group. And as I started going into it, I'd say about a year into it, I realized, look, this isn't really about Al-Qaeda. This is about a broader thing. It's about Salafism and a particular strain of Salafism, Salafi jihadism. And that's when I thought, I'm onto something. So I ended up having to junk a lot of the work from the first year, but I repurposed it, and here we are.
How did you go about actually sort of researching the book? It must have been quite a big process, sort of.
It was quite laborious. It was quite difficult. I wasn't always sure what I was going to be doing, but I, in the end, decided, okay, it has to be a thematic book, looking, because the timeline and chronology of each of the five ideas, are five ideas in the book that I say are the essential and irreducible sort of features or defining facets of this idea. And so each one, the history starts in a different point. So there's a chapter on Wala wal Bara, which is essentially love and hate for the sake of God, which is really looking at developments from the 18th and 19th century onwards. It's relatively recent. Whereas in the chapter on Takfir, which is the process of excommunication, declaring other Muslims to be heretics, that really takes place from almost the dawn of Islam. And so I realized I had to construct the book in a thematic way, dealing with each idea in isolation separately. And then it was really a case of going and finding all the various books that had been released and talked about in relation to these things. And so one of the advantages of the current age, I suppose, that the jihadist movement, of course, publishes all those books online. So you could go on the internet and find them. So I was obviously in a phase of downloading reams of jihadist propaganda material off the web in order to better understand this. But, you know, some of these concepts are quite complex. They're quite dense. I wouldn't say I was expert in them before I started. So there were times when I was having to teach myself and learn myself about what something was and then what they had done to it, and then to find a way to explain it to a Western audience as well that didn't require a huge grounding in Islam or Islamic theology. So there were multiple challenges on the way.
Yeah, no, I bet. Can you tell us what is Salafism and sort of where it fits into the faith of Islam?
So Salafism is a tradition within Islam, within Sunni Islam, and it's a highly regressive and literalist practice of Islam. I would say that Salafis tend to be people you would see as being, I suppose, if they're walking down the street, they're the most identifiably Muslim, they're visibly Muslim. So the women tend to wear the full face veil with just their eyes showing. The men tend to wear the robe, usually having it above their ankles. They have long beards. And so on. So I suppose in that sense, you know, the caricature image or the tabloid image is they're the identifiably, visibly Muslim people. But really what Salafism is about, what the name means, is a longer title really, is Salafus Salihin, is the righteous, the pious predecessors. And that refers to the first three generations of Muslims that surrounded the Prophet Muhammad. So it was his immediate companions, their children, and the children's children. And this is taken to constitute the golden age of Islam, the most pious and authentic phase of Islam that existed. And so the Salafi movement today says, we want to live the lives of the Salafis Salihin. We want to live the lives of the pious predecessors. So it believes in going backwards to living the life of those people, to trying to uncover and revive the authenticity, as it were, of the practice of Islam that they had. And in doing so, they're very rejectionist of modernity or attempts to marry Islam with more modern or progressive interpretations.
So what is Salafi jihadism and how did that come about?
So when I look at the Salafis, there was a scholar who wrote a book several years before I did, who actually said, you know, you can see the Salafis break into three categories. And I broadly adopt his categories. And these are the quietists, and that's the overwhelming number of Salafis. And really, they're concerned about themselves. Their primary concern is about getting themselves to heaven and their families to heaven. They're not really concerned with you or with society, and much less so with politics. So these are the quietists, the religious ascetics, really, more than anything. And then you have a second, slightly smaller category, which are the politicos, and these people engage with the world politically, but they don't believe in revolutionary change, they believe in organic change. There aren't really political Salafis in the West. It's mostly a movement you find within the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia in particular. And again, they are fascinating people, and there's a very good book actually all about them. So there's a very good study done on them and how they operate and what they do. And then after that, you have the jihadists, which is the smallest category of the lot, but it's clearly the one that grabs all the attention. They are rejectionist. They are the ones who don't believe in working with the political system or disengaging from it. They believe in radically uprooting it and overturning it fundamentally. And so I start the book by saying, look, here is Salafism as a tradition. This is what Salafism is. And then I titrate down to say, here are the different categories, and it's this last sliver that we're looking at. We're going to focus in on these guys and work them out.
Do all Salafis subscribe to Salafi jihadism?
No. A lot of Salafis, in fact, quietest Salafis, would say that Salafi jihadis have made a number of grotesque errors. They would use the label of Khawarij often against them, which is a highly loaded pejorative term. It refers to a historical episode in the early days of Islam where a community of people became renegades and rogues. They essentially broke off from the community, declared themselves the only true Muslims, and then fought the established community of Islam, and they were subsequently crushed and overrun. So to call someone a Khawarij today is very, as I say, it's loaded, it's pejorative. And that's the kind of language you see being used between the different parties. So for most Salafis, they are rejecting and opposing the jihadi Salafis, and they feel quite hard done by that. They are sort of the caricature that is defining them.
Mm. It kind of reminds me of, do you remember the film Four Lions?
Sorry, yeah, yeah.
Digressing, sorry, because the brother of the terrorist, I think, was a Salafi, was he? You know, and he was a very peaceful one, but he was the one who ended up getting arrested for being a suspect.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. It's that sort of thing. Like, well, we're being the suspect community when it's these guys over here.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so the Salafis are constantly, like, banging their head, really, saying, well, you know, what's going on here? We're being associated with this when we're really not about that.
Yeah. So some commentators like to point to Salafism as evidence of Islam being fundamentally violent. So how representative of the Islamic faith is Salafism and Salafi jihadism, and how do ordinary Muslims view Salafism?
Well, Salafism is one of the traditions within one of the branches of Islam. So Salafism is practiced by Sunni Muslims, and it's part of the tradition, but, you know, there are Sufi Muslims, there are Deobandi Muslims, there are Muslims of all different kinds of backgrounds and practices and so on. I think one of the difficulties for me, being a Muslim myself, particularly when writing this book, is to avoid making subjective comments and is to avoid getting into the debate. So I say quite early on in the book, look, I'm going to approach this matter with dispassionate objectivity. That's the real aim here. Just to sort of stand back and say, here it is as it stands. I'm going to explain concepts to you as they've been understood by the radicals, and not to say I buy into it. It's not to say I think it's good theology or bad theology. It's just here is what they have done and interpreted of it. So I think Salafis in general are sometimes viewed with suspicion, even by other Muslims, because they say, you're part of the problem. Salafism is so hardline and uncompromising or sort of unmalleable that even other Muslims feel hard done by. And you do see that to some extent when you have Sufi Muslims, for example, who are much more about revering the Prophet and having a connection with the Prophet and so on. If they go to Medina, where obviously the Saudi state is in charge, they get told off, they may get harassed by the authorities if they are wanting to practice in their own ways. So there are tensions within Islam in that sense. But, you know, Salafism is part of the Islamic tradition, and I don't think any attempts to sort of rule them as renegades or something are particularly helpful. It's a large part of the Islamic faith, and a large number of people think that that's the appropriate way to understand God.
Okay. And Salafi jihadism has been described as a political religion and similar to totalitarian political thinking such as Nazism, communism, and Western culture. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think the Salafi jihadi movement is sometimes comparable to these totalitarianisms that we've seen in the past. In some senses, it operates just like a contemporary fascistic movement that arcs towards power. It prioritizes power, and it licenses and unleashes all kinds of grotesque violence, often against the very constituency in whose name it claims to be acting, or in whose interest it claims to be acting, in order to realize its fundamental vision. So it's a hugely problematic thing that that these groups do. But when I look at it, what makes a young man from Portsmouth or Brighton or Cardiff give up their life here and travel to somewhere like Syria and Iraq to be part of Islamic State and to engage in all the grotesque brutalities that they've engaged in and so on? And you do see elements of this new political religion arising. Because without being too esoteric, and I kind of avoid going into too much depth about it in the book, precisely for that reason, is that there's a broader crisis of liberalism we see in the Western world today. So as we lead increasingly isolated lives, we live in increasing silos. In fact, the whole digital world we live in reinforces those silos. So to give an example, when you're on Twitter, you are essentially curating your own news timeline of the world. That will essentially reflect your views. So if you follow a particular football team and that's what you're interested in, you may be getting all the updates about that team. But you're not reading in a rounded way, in a way that you would if you bought a newspaper that in theory covers lots of different things from around the world. So there's this broader crisis, and you see that being manifest in so many ways. I think Brexit, to an extent, could point towards some of the crisis in liberalism, the rise of Donald Trump and populist movements across Europe, AfD, Pegida, these types of things are symptomatic of this broader quest that lots of people have for identity, belonging, a sense of trying to make sense of the world, which over the last 15 years has seemed to unravel established orthodoxies of power, have unraveled. And so people are sort of trying to work out and fit in, well, where do I stand in relation to all of this? And if you're a young Muslim who's grappling with these questions, you're sort of slightly more in the eye of that storm, because a lot of that crisis is also coming about from your own religious and civilizational aspect. It's imploding right now in Syria and Iraq. And you have a group like IS that can offer this very powerful, transformative message. I mean, in essence, what is Islamic State's message? It's make Islam great again. And all the things that that means, the vagueness of it, but the transformative inspiration of something like that, as we see Trump do. And so these people go.
Mm, kind of gives them a sense of purpose, doesn't it? Yeah.
Purpose, power, authority, direction, meaning, you know, all of these things are hugely important. So I do see Salafi jihadism as being a new political religion in that sense. It's filling this vacuum and void that exists and giving people direction.
In your book, the 1990s cast a kind of key moment in political Islamic thought, and I've also been told there was a boom of Salafi literature in the 90s as well. Can you tell us a bit about why that time was so crucial and how it led to the birth of groups such as Al-Qaeda?
The 90s is a really crucial moment, and I think it gets overlooked. And that was one of the bits I was quite pleased with in the book, actually. I think I bring the focus back to the 1990s as a transformative era, because we tend to look at Afghanistan in the 1980s and say, oh, look, here were these Arab guys who went off to fight jihad in Afghanistan. And, you know, at one time we thought it was a good thing. And now with the post-9/11 climate, we were like, oh, it's a bit weird. And then the sort of narrative drops off to the 1990s. We're just like, well, we know bin Laden was in Sudan and then he goes back to Afghanistan. Okay. But no one's really told the story of what was happening. And so I think it's one of the most important transformative periods intellectually for the development of this movement, because you have this group of irregular fighters who go off to Afghanistan in the 1980s, but there's no thinking behind it. There's no real vision or plan. It's just a vague notion, this is a good thing and help your Muslim brother. What really becomes a pivot point is when Saddam Hussein invades Kuwait and Saudi Arabia invites the United States to come and help in the military defense of the kingdom. And given that Saudi Arabia is really one of the most important countries in terms of having Salafism as a state faith, but the Gulf more generally is really the home of Salafism, all these clerics and thinkers start to have a discussion. I actually lived in Saudi Arabia at the time when this happened, so I remember it quite vividly, and I remember that awakening my early political thinking, that people were saying in the mosques, well, is it acceptable from within Islam to have the United States come to this holy land and establish military bases here? We're not really comfortable with that. And for the first time, you had dissent, you had open public debate that hadn't existed in Saudi Arabia before then. And so people were furiously writing pamphlets and books trying to justify each side of that. But you had this quite large movement emerge, the Sahwa, the Awakening, who are now a lot of them political Salafis, who came out in opposition to the government. And they weren't calling for radical revolution, but they were definitely telling the government, you need to reform yourself and you need to fix yourself up and to be more Islamic. And bin Laden was trying to position himself actually behind that for quite a while. He was fortunate in the sense that, of course, he was an insider. So domestically, the government cracked down, arrested all of these people, and began to persecute them. And so they kept inviting bin Laden to come back, and he said, no way, I know what you'll do. And from abroad, they moved to more of a, okay, we, you know, talking to them, advising them, calling upon them hasn't worked. We need to go from engagement to confrontation. And I think that's when the path towards confrontation begins to be set. And so I kind of try and lay out in the book how that recalibration takes place.
Excellent. And the second Gulf War, the War of 2003, is also a sort of turning point as well, isn't it? And one thing that was interesting, a lot of commentators sort of like to present these sort of jihadi groups as sort of one cohesive force, but you were sort of saying that there was huge divisions that came out because of the Gulf War and the global jihadi movement.
There was the Gulf War again, the second one, 2003 invasion of Iraq, was yet another really important moment in terms of doing this. I mean, one of the interesting things when I look at it is when you think about Islamic law, or indeed when you think about any law, in theory, the law is directing and shaping behavior. Whereas what I've seen and what I argue in the book is actually it's the events themselves, the wars that take place and the political upheavals that are shaping the law. So there's a constant sense of refining Islamic law or reinterpreting Islamic law in particular ways in response to events as they transpire and take place on the ground. So I think that's quite significant. And 2003 is really important for that because Al-Qaeda is attempting to, first of all, it's buoyed by the fact that it's pulled off 9/11 and it feels like the West isn't invincible and it's had this ability to pierce the Western defense and security infrastructure. And then here comes the United States. It's in the region along with Britain, the traditional enemies, and they are trying to market to the broader Muslim world to say, here are our reasons for fighting them. Here's our expression. You should be joining us. And that process of engaging with the broader Arab world, again, forces them to produce lots of literature. Again, it sparks a big debate. Is this valid? Is this not? Where do you stand? But I think it also helps them crystallize their own thoughts. And so I think, again, intellectually, for the development of this movement, it's a hugely critical time. In fact, I don't think the notion of Salafi jihadism as a movement or as an idea is completely crystallized or coherent on September the 11th. In some respects, it's a post 9/11 construct. But I don't go into that so explicitly in the book because I just thought it was a sideshow and I was going to maybe make an argument that people would find controversial that detracted from what I'm really trying to say.
Yeah, no, it's fair enough. And with the current war in Syria and the rise and potential fall of ISIS now, where is the ideology of Salafi jihadism today?
So Syria and Iraq, given the extent of the crisis today, you would expect them, from everything we've seen, to be sort of leading to a new phase yet again in the development of Salafi thinking. And we're sort of relatively early still into this, but you can already notice a few things. I mean, again, it dawned on me as an afterthought. I gave this book to a friend of mine who's a barrister, and I wanted him to read it as a sort of intelligent non-specialist to gauge. And he said, you know, there's got to be a lot more Islamic State in this book. Why is there no Islamic State? And I was like, oh, yeah, you know. And then it dawned on me, actually, Islamic State isn't producing reams of material the way Al-Qaeda used to. And so when I'm looking for Islamic State's books, when you're looking for their literature, their actual in-depth theological material, there isn't much. There's the odd thing that comes out here and there, but there isn't an advanced or sophisticated book. Whereas, to give you an example, Al-Qaeda Iraq after 2003 produced a book on human shields that was about 50 pages long, explaining their attitude towards human shields and, you know, why they could be killed in certain circumstances, classifying them in four different ways and all these kinds of things. So you read something like that from the perspective of a researcher and you're like, great, that's a chapter of the book. You go to Islamic State and there's nothing like that. So they burn a man alive in a cage with the Jordanian pilot Muad al-Qisasbi. And this is a hugely controversial moment, even for radical jihadists who are like, whoa, they've overstepped the market. you would expect a booklet. You would expect it. And they produced one small paragraph essentially saying, here's why we've done it. And then you had to go back and work it out for yourself, and so on. So the point is, I don't see Islamic State as doing anything that interesting right now from an ideological, intellectual point of view. Whereas Al-Qaeda was always keen to say, we are part of a chain of continuity of Islamic thought. They were keen to posit themselves within Islamic tradition. And again, I don't make a value judgment whether they achieved that or not. I'm just saying, here's what they attempted to do. So they would go back to important Islamic figures from Islamic antiquity, such as Ibn Taymiyyah. They would go back to various things and try to bring them out to say, here we are in this arc of Islamic thought and development over time. Then, what they do now in Syria and Iraq, I think, is showing that they're still the more interesting movement from an intellectual perspective. So you're seeing what I'm calling a sort of theological pragmatism evolve here, which is that they're implementing a Sharia light, as it were, in different senses. They are basically saying, you don't need to implement the Hudud punishments. These are the sort of famous Islamic punishments mentioned in the scripture, such as chopping the hand of the thief. So they say you can suspend this, and here is a precedent for suspending it from Islamic history. You can suspend it in times of calamity or famines, of tumultuous uprisings, and so on. And clearly Syria is undergoing a huge humanitarian crisis, so we are going to suspend the rules. So in the areas that they're governing in, they are developing a slightly more pragmatic program for engagement and for outreach, and that's designed to win popular support. And so when I look at it like that, I'm like, wow, they are really onto something here.
Mm-hmm. You did mention just now, I mean, like, Al-Qaeda and ISIS are using different approaches for religious justification and positioning of their actions. Why should we say, is ISIS, I guess, making less of an effort on the religious justification?
Yeah, it's really hard to know. There's no good answer for it. Whether they feel like it's all been said before and therefore they don't need to, that could be one thing, although we're speculating. And the other thing I sometimes think is they believe they've established a caliphate and therefore Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is the Khalif. And traditional jurisprudence essentially says the Khalif is the executive. What he says go, all authority resides in him. He can have a sort of consultation council, known as a Shura Council, and so on around him, but it's purely advisory. It's essentially up to, provided he adopts from within the corpus of Islamic opinion. So if he said, everyone must stop going to Friday prayers and instead get drunk and eat baked sandwiches, you'd say, okay, he's clearly violating Islamic law and this is, we don't follow him. But even if he picks something quite esoteric from within the body of Islamic literature and says, this is my opinion, that for the sake of the unity of the movement, you would go with him, even if you thought there were strong opinions were elsewhere. So again, Islamic State may be saying, you know what, he's depicting these opinions and we don't need to justify them. He's the executive. We therefore simply follow and obey. That could be part of it, but it's not clear. They've never given a reason for why they don't put out a lot of material.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan. And we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
And one thing I've noticed is like Salafi jihadist groups like to push this an idea of a clash of civilizations as the West wants to destroy the Muslim world. Can you talk us through why that's important to them?
It's integral to the Salafi jihadi view, actually, that they regard Islam and the West as being fundamentally incompatible. They say that these things are completely separate, that nothing good can come from anything that's not Islam itself. So that even if you do a positive act by virtue of being a non-Muslim who does it. So you give money to charity, you help an old lady cross the street, that kind of thing. Because your frame of reference isn't from within Islam itself, or you were motivated by an Islamic principle to do it, then the act in of itself is meaningless. They're really, in some respects, quite supremacist. They're basically saying, look, nothing matters in the world other than Islam, and Islam is the source of everything. And therefore, you know, you become engaged in this notion of the clash of civilizations as being the only way for the world to proceed, because what they would say is, you know, truth and falsehood have to fight it out, haq and batil. And they fight it out to see who triumphs in that way. So it's a really integral part of the Salafi jihadi worldview. It's essentially the underlying cause of their whole mission, is to establish the authority of Islam politically and to use it as a launch pad to expand continuously across the globe to acquire more territory for the glory of Islam.
Well, a lot of commentators put a lot of weight behind the religious motivation of terrorists. But is Islamist terrorism really just a way to recruit sort of fighters for a political struggle?
The extent to which religious ideas matter to people, it's the average fighters. Again, if we say the guy from Portsmouth, Brighton, Cardiff, Birmingham, wherever, who goes off to join Islamic State, has he sat there and read the great works of the Salafi jihadi theorists? Does he know the concept of wala wal bara as they developed? So no, I don't think there is a sophisticated understanding. As part of the work, again, that I've been doing at ICSR here at King's, is we've interviewed about 100 foreign fighters who went off to participate in Syria and Iraq using smartphone applications and things like that. And they're all religiously unsophisticated, they're religious novices and so on. That's not so important in the sense of, you know, how does an ideology work? We tend to think of people who get involved in ideological movements or in ideological causes as being, or presupposing that they must have read all the key literature and had these quite in-depth considered notions about what it is they're going to, which is all, of course, nonsense. Mass movements that are ideologically driven have people that buy in at the base level for all kinds of reasons, usually with very poor understanding. But it's the sort of ideological oversight that comes from the leadership that invests their meaning, their actions with meaning, that gives their actions direction and so on. So to give you an example, if I ran out of this building now and stabbed someone in the street, it would be treated as an ordinary criminal act. Maybe I'm trying to mug him, maybe there's a dispute. But if I do the same act and shout Allahu Akbar and say that I've done it out of loyalty to the Khalif Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, exactly the same act, but by virtue of sins, it's suddenly become a highly politicized act invested with great ideological significance. And that's the way ideologies work. That's the way movements work, in that they are able to force project in a different way. And so the example I often give, and it's not my own, although it's been attributed to me by other people, which is very kind of them, but it's not my own. I read it somewhere, I just can't remember where. It's talking about the power of ideas and the history of ideas, and it said, you know, had every prison guard at Auschwitz read Mein Kampf? Of course they hadn't. Does that mean the ideas contained within Mein Kampf mattered? Clearly they did. And that's the same thing I think we have to think about when we look at Salafi jihadis today.
Well, you mentioned you've interviewed fighters and things. You've gone from Britain to Iraq and Syria. So what is it that makes a British-born and educated person up sticks and fly off to a war zone?
Well, some of the stuff we've already touched upon, the broad abstract level, which is these crises of civilization, of liberalism, of finding yourself. I think identity plays a huge role in a lot of this. Clearly some of them, and you know, we shouldn't deny this, clearly some of them are highly religiously motivated. They believe this is what God wants them to do, what God expects of them, and so off they go. They also believe very strongly in the sort of virtues, as it were, of martyrdom. If they were killed out there, they'll be martyred and get a shortcut to paradise with all the sort of nirvanas that come with that. But really, when I'm looking at the sort of the group dynamic of people going, there's all sorts of elements that we've seen from World War One, World War II, masculinity, emotional blackmail. What will you do when this great struggle for the caliphate was happening. Were you sitting at home playing PlayStation? You weren't saving your brothers and sisters. So there was a lot of that. And as I say, there was a sense of like this was like a boyish summer camp. I mean, we saw these guys out there with guns, with weapons, living in these big communal halls, saying, you know, why aren't you coming up? We're living better lives than we were living in the West, is what they were saying. And we're with our friends, and we're also noble. So that's also quite strong in many senses. And we saw there was just a lot of it was, you know, boys being boys in this sort of, you must prove your masculinity. And the way you do it is by picking up a Kalashnikov in Syria and Iraq. One of my colleagues has just done, in fact, two of them have just done a big report looking at the crime-terror nexus. And again, found a lot of criminals been involved in going over or getting involved in jihadist movements. Again, for them, narratives of redemption are quite strong and powerful, saying, you know, well, you've lived this bad life, you were a drug dealer, you were in a gang or whatever, and now, look, here you are, like, your sins are being washed away because you're a mujahid and so on, and yet you're still kind of engaged in clandestine, subversive activity, but now you're doing it from a prison of being someone who, at least in some narrative, is being held up to be a noble warrior and a good person. So there's a multiplicity of different things going on that we've seen.
It's interesting you mentioned the criminality. It reminds me of the story of Morton Storm. I don't know if you're familiar with the guy who then infiltrates Al-Qaeda as a CIA and MI5 and many other intelligence services agents. Because he was a biker, wasn't he, I think.
Exactly. So again, Morton Storm is a good example of someone who's, you can see if looking at his life, he's always been seeking adventure. He's always been wanting to be part of something. And whether it's being a biker, being a radical Muslim, what he's doing now, there's always been the sort of same traits are there. They're just manifesting in different ways.
And what methods are these groups using to recruit various individuals to go and fight for them?
Well, different narratives, I think, have played out at different moments in time in this conflict. So in the early stages, 2012 and 2013, where people were going, it was very much about come and save your brothers and sisters from oppression. Here is a tyrant. You must defeat him, Bashar al-Assad. Help the civilians, help the civilians. And so loads of those early people, in fact, as we encountered them, were very much about saving civilian lives, saying we are here to help the people. Then that was the narrative. From sort of mid of 2013 onwards, as ISIS began to consolidate control, particularly over the eastern sides of Syria, and Deir ez-Zor and Raqqa and so on, the narrative became more about, you know, establish a caliphate, we're here to establish Islam, we're establishing an Islamic state. And people were then being motivated by that. At other moments, this isn't strictly chronological, obviously when Hezbollah was openly involved in the conflict and Iranian forces were coming as well, the sectarian element as well, like, look, this is a battle for the future direction of Islam, you must come and push back against these Shias who are coming in. And so the Sunni-Shia thing became more pronounced and sort of slightly more established in the narrative. And then finally, of course, when the caliphate itself is announced, that's the fact you're obligated now to come and live in it. You should come and be part of this new society. So everyone who went at different moments was responding to different parts of those narratives, and they were slightly more pronounced at different times. And you can see now the flow of Sunni foreign fighters into this conflict has fallen off by something like 90%, 95%. You know, people aren't going, and that foreign fighter flow seems to have died away. And that's because some of these groups are on the retreat. The narrative isn't as strong for them as it used to be. So the game has changed a little bit in that sense.
Yeah, that's very interesting, actually. So, because obviously there's still this massive fear about sort of these people bringing the training back home and things like that. But I'd not heard that before, that the less Sunnis going out now. That's really interesting.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's completely dropped off. You know, for Islamic State to try and attract people now, well, what would make you go today that wouldn't have made you go a year ago? So in a sense, that those who were going to go, I think, have gone. And that momentum and that ability to project success that ISIS had, of capturing new cities and so on, is severely being challenged now. They're on the back foot. They inflict suffering losses. And so that's making them sort of pull back a little bit. So, oh, you know, hang on. It's making people rethink the sort of validity of going out there.
A law enforcement contact of mine once described religious extremism as being a bit like a business, like the drug trade. To what extent do you think extremism is a business, always like a business?
Well, I mean, people have drawn all these kinds of links as far as, you know, it's these things are run like cartels, they're run like mafias, and so on. And so I think there is that sort of sense of that happening. As I say, we are doing more work, and it's new, but we are looking more at financial crime and terrorism, and the sort of crime-terror nexus. And you do see the same things applying, in that people who are operating in clandestine fashion, who are quite comfortable regularly breaking the law, and that's not just, you know, doing 75 miles an hour on the motorway, but selling drugs or involved in gangs and stuff, then moving into terrorist networks isn't all that difficult for them. It's not like they're coming from a completely a sort of clean perspective, as it were. They've already become familiarized with breaking the law, and they're quite comfortable with it. And I think that's something you sort of notice a bit with people involved. And of course, they have skills that are valuable. So if you look at the November attacks, for example, in Paris of last year, then there was clear overlap with criminal networks. And you need the criminal networks, because you and I, as ordinary law-abiding citizens, don't know how to get our hands on AK-47s on the streets of Paris. But clearly, so there are people out there who do know how to do this. And that's what makes it relevant and important.
And one other thing that comes up a lot when we talk about terrorism and Salafi jihadism, a lot of commentators like to point the finger at Saudi Arabia or private donors in the Gulf state for bankrolling the development of Salafi jihadism. Is there any truth to this from what you've seen from your research?
Well, I'd say I'm not, you know, the primary expert on this, but let's be clear, the idea that ISIS is funded by any state, whether it's the Saudis, Qataris, Turkeys, is nonsense. ISIS is as much, if not more, of an existential threat to them than it is even to the West. And it wants to target those countries more than it does the West. So you've seen a number of ISIS suicide bombers in Saudi Arabia, for example. Turkey's had more ISIS attacks than anybody else. So these are clearly is a nonsense. The broader thing, however, is that the Gulf states and people around the world in general do fund Salafi projects. And the firewall between Salafi jihadism and quieter Salafis is not always as well established or developed as it should be. So there's clear evidence, I think, of cases where things spill over, where things inadvertently go this way. So is it strictly true to say that they fund it? Well, yes and no. I don't think there's a sort of conscious thought out plan, but definitely the money flows. And again, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey in particular are not going to let the other parts of the Syrian opposition go down. Groups like Ahrar al-Sham, for example, who are still highly Salafi, who are still highly conservative in their views, and who are jihadis, but are operating with just a slightly different agenda insofar as I would describe them being Islamo-nationalist in orientation. So they want to take over Syria, and that's essentially, at least for now, the scope of their ambition. Whereas a group like Islamic State, of course, wants to be New York, London, Paris, Rome.
So we've seen a lot of members of the far right who are trying to equate all Muslims with terrorism. We've seen members of the far left sharing platforms and apologising for terrorists and extremists. And it's led to a lot of confusion on the topic. And it's causing an increasingly toxic atmosphere for Muslims and non-Muslims who want to bring the violence to an end. In your opinion, what are Muslims and non-Muslims getting wrong about Islam and counter-terrorism?
Well, I think, as you say, actually, there's a sense in the public debate to go one or two ways at polarized levels. One is to say, this is nothing to do with Islam. These guys are all psychopaths, and they're just crazy people. And I understand why people say that, and it's born of sincerity, but it's also nonsense. And it doesn't help Muslims, and it doesn't help the debate. Because what it does is it fuels grievance narratives on the other side. People saying, "Oh, you're covering up for them." It's not helping Muslim liberals who are trying to counteract some of this, because they're being told, "Look, Islam. There's no problem here, right? And there's no issue." And then on the flip side, of course, all Muslims are terrorists, and you never know when your Muslim neighbor might strap on a suicide bomb and blow up the Northern Line. Well, that's also just nonsense. So the debate is very, very difficult, and I think, particularly in the public arena, it's sort of, you do have to despair sometimes at the way it stands. But what do people get wrong? I think people just don't understand. I mean, You said, well, look, it says this in the Quran. It's like, and so what? This idea that there's one Islam, or that you take a verse from the Quran at face value, literally, and then go and implement it, is also just a nonsense. It's not how I understand Islam. It's not how most Muslims understand Islam, nor have thousands of years of Islamic scholarship said that's how you do it. You know, Muslims believe the Quran was revealed piecemeal in relation to circumstances and events over a number of years. And so when you're looking at a particular verse, you have to look at the context in which it comes. You have to look at the situation. You have to look at what constricts that verse and what doesn't make, what makes it general, what doesn't. And all these sorts of different things that would allow Muslims to sort of extrapolate rulings and understandings. So in the public debate on a lot of this, I just kind of despair at all levels when I see from Anjum Chowdhury to Tommy Robinson to various people who are engaged in this, and I think are coming at it in a sensationalist way. So I said, is there a problem? Yes. Is it as bad as, you know, everyone's making out? Well, we need to work out how to challenge it and fix it. But, you know, and that requires like a greater sort of more responsible debate from the wider community. But we also need more Muslims to be coming at this issue and to challenging it without being defensive. And again, I feel like slowly but surely these things are happening. But it's going to take a long time.
Yeah, are there any good places for listeners to sort of read more, should we say, balanced articles, stories? Because I find the new a lot of the news and things like that tends to be very sensationalist in its reporting, and it becomes very difficult for listeners to sort of find quality information about this topic.
It is very difficult to find quality information. I think, you know, there are more and more books now looking at this kind of issue. And stuff. So there was a book that's come out, you know, looking at the life of Abdul Wahhab. I think that's very good in terms of you want to understand the basis of the contemporary Saudi state, of how most Salafis view their religion. These are good things. I mean, traditionally, academics have not worked on this kind of stuff, but it's changing. Even the academic landscape is changing. And I think that's important. So that I notice now this book's been a long time in the making. It's, you know, more than 6 years. Where the debate was when the book started and where the debate is now, and not that it's a result of the book, because the book has been a product of the environment in which it was conceived as well, which is that there is more nuance, there is more intelligent commentary that is emerging, rather than this, you know, God, these guys with beards want to kill us all. So I would recommend your readers to definitely take to Amazon, basically, and then to look to some of the more authoritative scholarly works on this issue that are positing and explaining what's happening in a more intelligent light. And a lot of French academics look at the situation in Europe, Olivier Roy, Gilles Capel, and Jean-Pierre Filieu, and so on. And I think they're doing some very good work on the situation in Europe as it stands. Same with Peter Nessa from Oslo. Again, very good book on the situation in Europe and how that stands. So I think that's a good starting point for people.
From what you've seen researching this topic, what is being done and what can be done to counter the Salafi jihadist narrative from gaining popularity?
Well, Salafi jihadism, ideas in general, and when you look at ideas and ideologies in general, they are still, like everything else, they rely on the political environment. They need context, momentum, and a success behind them in order to drive them forward. So you almost, as it were, needed the Soviet Union to fail to suck a lot of momentum out of communism. But there are still communists today, but they're not as many as they were two, three decades ago. And it's the same thing here, that Salafi jihadism is a problematic, a manifestation of Islamic belief that some people have chosen to construct and buy into. It does need to be militarily defeated, as it is being in Syria and Iraq. It needs a general change in the political settlement of the Middle East for the better, so that people aren't turning to these things. You can legitimately, as a citizen of Egypt, Syria, Iraq, Saudi, Qatar, vote out your government or whatever it is, take your elected leaders and hold them to account in a way that doesn't require you to be doing this. So all of that's the longer-term structural stuff. Theologically and ideologically, this battle for Islam and the soul of Islam is taking place. You know, we are living through it. And that's, again, kind of one of the things I'm showing in the book is a huge debates within Islam, within Salafism as well, for authenticity and understanding over particular ideas. So as that continues, and that will continue, you know, these ideas will evolve, movements will fall and die. I don't think this will last forever, but it's certainly around. And whilst it won't last forever, I dare say all of us won't be alive to see the end of it. It'll last for a while.
It'll go beyond us.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah. Quick bonus question. Half embarrassed about it, but in a similar vein to the Clash of Civilizations narrative, I have seen an increasing popularity in conspiracy theories about who actually runs Al Qaeda, ISIS, and I've been told by some well-meaning Muslim friends of mine that really all the violence in the Middle East is some part of an elaborate plan run by the West to divide Muslims in the Middle East. Why do you think these type of theories are gaining traction or have gained traction?
Yeah, God, the conspiracy theory in the Muslim world stuff. I mean, I encounter it when I go to Pakistan. It's so well entrenched, but it's not unique to Pakistan. I think there's a sense of two or three things. I mean, one is they can't make sense of all of this, or the idea that Muslims are doing this to other Muslims. So this sense, it must be coming from outside, it must be directed, because, you know, we all really like each other deep down. It's like, are you kidding me? But there's that sense of, you know, oh, this is all being driven to make us fight each other, to kill each other, and to keep us sort of divided. It's a real problem because it's denying the reality. You know, but people also need conspiracy because it basically gives order and structure and sense to a world that doesn't make any sense and doesn't have order or structure. So when you need that, you need the answers. And so sometimes this fits in with the pattern of thinking there, okay, there's got to be a grand plan here because we should be doing better than we are and we're not. Someone's directing it. It's malignant. It's coming from the West. It's coming from outside. But, you know, I would say to them, this idea that there's some grand strategy that's being hatched in the Pentagon or in the Foreign Office, and literally it's being played out in Syria and Iraq, as if there's some overlords playing a game of chess. You should go meet these civil servants. They don't have a clue what's going on. The idea that the FCO can coherently run a disaster in Syria is nonsense. They're no more able to put that together than they are to put something successful. So, you know, it's always makes me laugh because I'm like, these are ordinary civil servants who are as confused, who are as scared, and as perplexed about everything that's happening as you are. It's just one of those particular pathologies right now that's going around.
Yeah, especially with the rise of sort of internet culture and things like that.
Exactly. You can find your own echo chambers where everyone supports your view, and so on. In fact, you know, some people did some interesting work. David Aronovich has done a good book on conspiracy theories, and some other people have done some work on that too. And there's some interesting things around there, like your lack of trust in your own government is one of the things. So the more distrustful you are, the more likely you are to believe in conspiracy theories. Problem in the region being, of course, that sometimes it's the governments themselves that are pushing these conspiracy theories. So Saad's narrative is this is all happening by the West to overthrow him and stuff. So you're literally within layers upon layers of smoke and mirrors, and you know, it's hard to see the wood for the trees.
Yeah, I suppose it's very useful for something like Assad because it helps shift the blame away from him, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thank you so much. Where can listeners find out more about you and your work?
So if you go to the website of ICSR, it's icsr.info, that's specifically our research centre's website, which is part of the War Studies Department at King's College London. So they definitely learn more about the work there. I'm on Twitter as well. It's just my full name, Shiraz Meher. You can see my random musings there, often about Syria, sometimes about cricket. Apart from that, it's the book on Amazon. And those, I suppose, are the three places I'm probably most present.
Excellent. Thank you again very much for joining me today.
Thanks for doing
that. Thank you. If you've enjoyed the show, please spread the word by connecting with us on Twitter by going to @drycleanercast. For more information about the podcast, please visit our website, www.drycleanercast.co.uk.
Thank you for listening to the Dry Cleaner Cast.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.